Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Author Bonnie Pipkin grew up in Chico. At age 18, she moved to New York. There she taught literature courses at Keene University, officiated weddings, ran an after-school theater program at a high school in Brooklyn, and got an MFA in writing for children and young adults at Vermont College of Fine Arts. She moved back to Chico in 2019 and was selected to be one of the North State Voices columnists for 2021 in the Chico Enterprise Record. Her debut young adult novel, Aftercare Instructions, has been optioned for television. Bonnie Pipkin, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
How did you get so lucky to have TV pick up your book?
I guess that is kind of the dream, huh? I got so lucky because I have really great agents who were really working very hard to champion this book. And my literary agent connected me with book-to-film agents at CAA, Creative Arts Agency in Hollywood. And yeah, they put it in the hands of the right people.
So is it a done deal or is it still in process?
It is a done deal in that there's a director, there's a writer, there's a production company. It still needs to find a home, but that's in the works as well. So,
well, now also there are a lot of writers record their own books, and I think you're going to be doing that, aren't you? Or have you already done it?
I've already done it. Yeah. So the audiobook came out when the book came out in 2017, and I did the audio recording.
My guest is Bonnie Pipkin, and she has written a novel for young adults, and the title of her novel is Aftercare Instructions. And the format is rather unusual, Bonnie. You mentioned you have experience with after-school theater program. So we start reading your book, and the next thing we know, we see a change in format. Explain your choice there. How did you come about? How did you choose the format of your book?
So the format you're talking about is that we kind of jump back into our flashback scenes, and they're written as a theater script. And where that came from was I wrote it through first without that. I wrote it as a straight narrative. And the feedback I kept getting was, why do we care about this relationship? Because the book opens and the boyfriend has just done something horrible. And so the feedback was always, why do we care? He's so bad to her. Why? So I thought that I had to show Genesis and Peter falling in love. And then I started thinking about the way that we kind of distill our memories and the way that we sometimes think about the things that have happened in our lives, and they feel like scenes from a movie or a play or something like that. And so I just really kind of wanted to play with that. And because theater is an important theme in the novel and in Genesis's healing, I thought it would be fun. So,
well, you mentioned your narrator's name is told in the first person, and she, further into the book, we learn why her parents chose that name. But why did you choose the name Genesis? That's an unusual name for a young girl. By the way, she's 17 years old, we might mention. And how did you choose that name for her?
There were a few things I was playing with. The first is that I had a student in Brooklyn named Genesis, and I really loved the name. I thought it was a very powerful name. And then, of course, the symbolism of Genesis, the beginning of things, and, you know, it being a young adult novel, a coming of age kind of story, sort of the genesis of her life. And then, of course, there's a theme of religion in the novel as well. And she has parts of her family that are very religious and parts that aren't. And her boyfriend is very religious and she's sort of agnostic. And so I was playing with that symbolism a little bit as well.
Well, you have a rather dramatic beginning to your story, Bonnie. Would you read the beginning of your book for us?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Preparation. A few things they tell you. No food or drink for 6 hours prior to appointment time. If you receive the IV conscious sedation, make sure to secure a ride home or have an escort for public transportation. Dress in loose, comfortable clothing with socks and flat shoes. Bring an extra pair of underwear and a sweater or sweatshirt. Bring picture identification and your insurance card if you're planning to use insurance. Payment is collected in full at the time of the visit. One and only one escort may accompany you to the health center. Your escort will be asked to wait in the designated waiting room and will not be allowed into the medical center with you. The thing I wish I'd known, I love you doesn't come with any guarantees.
So this is the very beginning of your story. And so far, we don't hear the narrator. We just get this list of a few things that they tell you as preparation. And we don't know who is this that's getting prepared and what are they getting prepared for. Mm-hmm. So would you continue reading, Bonnie? There are choices.
Yes. Choices. Sometimes you make a choice that can save your life. You might make your choice for one reason before the real reason even becomes clear. Like this morning when I refused the sedation. The reason was because I wanted to feel it. I wanted to feel my choice as it left my body. I didn't know it would actually make all the difference in the world when my one and only one escort failed mid-procedure, and I found out by walking into the waiting room, scanning a sea of hopeful eyes, and finding absolutely nowhere safe or familiar to land. In that moment, I was thrown into the deep, deep water, and in the deep, deep water, there's no way to breathe. Yet somehow, something propels you forward. Survival mode, I think it's called. You can do this. Just get yourself to Port Authority. You've done this before when Rose wanted to shop for stupid dance dresses in Soho. You've done this when you've gone to visit Delilah. You can get yourself home. To get back, you have to move forward. Just move forward. I cross the street and stop. Pull out my phone and find the screen black, blank. I squeeze it like I could force out a text message from Peter, a text telling me he will be right back for me, that he just had to go get something real quick, some city errand he wanted to take the opportunity to do, and that he's so sorry it seemed any other way, and that he loves me, and that maybe one day we'll be ready, but we made the right choice for right now, and that he's here for me no matter what. No matter that our lives are so different, and no matter that I don't have anyone offering me guidance, that he's here for me while I figure this stuff out. But nothing appears. And I have to figure out how to get myself home now. No sedation, no escort, just me and my extra pair of underwear.
This is novelist Bonnie Pipkin. She lives in Chico now, but she did spend 21 years in New York. And this is where your story is set, Bonnie. So this is familiar territory for you, is it not?
Yes, it is. I was drawing from my own experiences of growing up in a smaller town, but I wanted to have access to New York City as well. So I actually set the novel in a fictional town in New Jersey on the coast, very close to the city, so that she could, you know, go back and forth to the city and I could write about New York City, but then also sort of write about the experience of being from a smaller town as well.
Well, you chose to go to New York City, and I was wondering, because it's such a huge theater center, if that was the attraction, is that what lured you to that big city? Was it because of your interest in theater?
I think that definitely had something to do with it. I've always just been drawn to the energy of cities. Growing up in Chico, and especially as a teenager, I wanted to go to San Francisco as much as possible. I just always have loved the culture and vibrancy in city living and the art and the theater, of course, and being a part of that kind of community.
Well, you taught literature and then you had this after-school theater program. And I remember when I was in high school, one of the teachers that people just loved did both direct the plays in theater and taught literature. And she was just such a favorite with that combination. And it sounds like that was appealing for you too, that you taught literature in these after-school programs.
Yeah, and the after-school program, there was really an emphasis on creating original works of theater too. So we would, with our students, we would really start with story building and creating something that was meaningful to them and, kind of teaching them how to construct a story. And so for me, story building and world creation and writing has always been a part of my art form and art practice. But I've always gone back to writing, even when I've dipped into performing and things like that. And reading, of course, I could talk about books forever, I think.
My guest is Chico author Bonnie Pipkin. She has written a novel, Aftercare Instructions. It's what we do after the hurt that matters. And so you start right out, the very beginning of your story is the hurt. And The story then unfolds. Now, you, part of your bio, you officiated weddings. That was in New York?
I did, yeah. this also ties into story creation, really, because I have always loved stories, and part of my officiant business was to create unique wedding ceremonies for my couples, and so a part of that was to interview them and really learn their story and try to capture that into a piece of writing that would be spoken, of course, so it, for me, it really combined a lot of things that I loved from writing to public speaking to just love and celebration in general.
Well, the season of the year that you chose was wintertime. And those of us living here in California aren't as familiar with that here, although we do get snow. And what went into your choice of season?
I think I started writing the book in winter, so I was probably heavily influenced by my surroundings, but I've always loved winter, and which is funny because we don't have super distinct seasons here, but and really when I lived in New York and people would learn I was from California, it was always like, oh, why, what are you doing here? Like, we want these winters. And I really always did. I love them. There's like, I don't know, it's peaceful for my soul, the cold and the starkness of it. And since moving back, I miss my winter jackets a lot.
You may be in the minority there, Bonnie.
I think so, yeah.
Now, I was intrigued by your chapter titles. You don't give your chapters numbers, but you give them rather interesting titles. The very first that you read from was called Choices. And what are some examples of your chapter titles, Bonnie?
So then in the course of the novel, the chapter titles are actually aftercare instructions after an abortion, and which is, of course, what Genesis goes through right at the beginning of the novel. And so I thought about those, and then the book is about healing on a physical level, but it's also about healing on an emotional level too. So there's something about the titles of these very physical healing aftercare instructions that could really tie into the emotion of the chapter as well, or at least that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, I thought it was appropriate because your book is entitled Aftercare Instructions, and here you have a chapter called Schedule Follow-Up, another Monitor Bleeding. And so I thought, yeah, that seems appropriate for your chapter headings, your chapter titles.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was, I was definitely playing with structure in this novel when I was creating it. Like I said, I started writing it straight through, but then I've always really been interested in playing with form and structure and what that can do for the narrative as well. Yeah.
Well, getting back to that group of that age group, high school students. So she starts out, she gets an abortion. Her boyfriend, you mentioned his name is Peter. And we really don't like Peter. Look what he did to her. And throughout the novel, we keep thinking, gosh, that guy is just, and we don't like him. And I don't want to spoil things for people because you don't know. You turn the page and think, oh my gosh, now what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's complicated. It was a really heavy thing that they both had to go through, and he really came from a much different family than she does. And, you know, their love story is complicated too. And it is hard to like someone who does something so horrible to someone else, but it also something I tried to tap into in this novel is that people do make mistakes, and, you know, that's really what makes us human. And I did try to give him some humanity ultimately. And that, like I said earlier, that's really what I was doing by trying to go back in time to show them falling in love. But it was the challenge. That was the challenge with his character. And I've certainly, you know, been in love or at least involved with people who it was questionable, but there's always reasons, you know.
My guest is novelist Bonnie Pipkin. Her novel, her debut novel, is for young adults, and it is Aftercare Instructions. Well, I say it's for it. The central character, the main character, the narrator, is a 17-year-old. With Aftercare Instructions, and one of the chapters, Recovery Times May Vary. But now on into the novel, you incorporate, I mentioned you describe the format, you have a script, but also in the story, the characters get interested in theater. And I was particularly interested in one of your instructions when they audition, because this happened to me. I happened to have been in Charleston at the time, and on the audition form, you had to write if you were going to have to miss some rehearsals. And so I was teaching at the College of Charleston. I was going to miss spring break. So I said, no, I can't. I won't be here to rehearse during this time, which is close to opening. And they said, oh, okay, well, we won't cast you. And then I got a call about a week before opening night and said, yeah, we want you in the cast now. So I know how that works when they say, let us know, list any conflicts that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny. I haven't auditioned for a play in a very, very long time, but when I was in high school, I would do stuff at the Blue Room Theater here. And I remember what it felt like to be a teenager, auditioning with all these older people who I thought were so cool. And, you know, I definitely was tapping into that experience when I was writing her auditioning. And I remember filling out those forms. It might actually be different now. It seems like everything is so digital now, but yeah, I definitely remember filling out those forms and, you know, worrying about my lack of experience and things like that.
Well, I mentioned when I introduced you that you were selected to be one of the North State Voices columnists for next year, for 2021 in the Chico Enterprise Record. So what will you be writing about in your column?
Well, the theme of the column is things that affect your day-to-day life, and I'll be writing 13 columns. There are four writers, and I don't know yet. in my application, one of the pieces I wrote was about joining CSA here when I moved back, that is run by a woman actually, who I thought was the coolest in high school, and how it sort of brought me back to that time, and how being back in Chico after being away for so long, I've sort of tapped back into this kind of teenage angst that I had left behind a little bit. And it's interesting. It's an interesting kind of reckoning to be new in town, in your hometown. And so that's kind of what I was writing about, how joining this CSA and getting vegetables every week and sort of having life become normal instead of these legendary figures from my youth. And so that was one column that I wrote for my application. I don't know if that will be one that's used, but yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing to be a writer for young adults and to be back in the town where I was a young adult. Because I actually think it'll be really good for my writing to tap back into that.
Well, we will look forward to the TV version of this, your creativity, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for telling us about your debut novel, Aftercare Instructions. My guest has been Bonnie Pipkin.
Thank you, Nancy.
After a break, I'll ask social worker Larry Levin about his novel about a 60s rock band. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Novelist Larry Levin is a licensed clinical social worker in private practice in Chico, California. He has worked in social services in various capacities since 1984, including 14 years in adoption services. Following his retirement from adoption services, he began writing a novel. He had written as a hobby since college and published some articles in local publications. He has also dabbled in music since college. His story of the Leon Lewis Band was in the making for a long time, and although it is a work of fiction, it has a factual basis. Larry Levin's first attempt at writing a novel is the story of a rock band in the 60s and 70s. The Leon Lewis Band traces the lives of the characters who comprise the band. Larry Levin, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Well, since I just mentioned that your novel traces the lives of the characters who comprise this band, I'd like for you to read, if you would, the very opening of your story, because it's told in the first person. So
yeah.
Would you read the first page of your book, please?
Sure. Yeah, the book is narrated by a best friend of Leon, a lifelong friend and fellow member of the band. And he tells the story. And it starts out with, "My name is Jackie Klein. I am a lifelong friend of Leon Lewis and proud member of the Leon Lewis Band. Our friendship was born on the streets of Brooklyn, not far from Coney Island. I lived down the street from Leon, one of a group of five 70 your old tenement buildings. We're a couple of the few Jewish kids in a predominantly Italian working class neighborhood. I was a quiet, shy boy. Lee, 3 years my senior, was outgoing and actively engaged in the struggle to gain respect from the other kids on the block. As a result, he continually suffered from the rampant anti-Semitism and aggressive competition of the street culture. But Lee was a tough kid and found ways to handle it. Compared to Lee, I was invisible on the block, unimportant and outcast. Whereas Lee, on the other hand, was more of a haunting aberration and ultimately a fugitive from the little neighborhood pecking order of street urchins competing for power as they developed their identity through their relationships with each other. Any degree of recognition or acceptance that I received was because of Lee. Nonetheless, initially I was an extra kid who Lee went to when things went sour with his supposed friends. If it were not for the common bonds of our Jewish heritage and our mutual love of music, I doubt if Lee would have paid any attention to me at all. Lee and I were very different in many ways, but we were drawn together by forces stronger than ourselves.
Thank you. This is Larry Levin. He's reading from his novel, which could qualify actually as historical fiction, could it not, Larry?
Yeah, the story is really about this band, but the band is really more than the musicians. It's their friends, their manager, and the people they meet along the way. And the band is a vehicle for telling a story from their perspective of America in that period from the 50s through the early 80s. So it's a very political story. They're rock musicians. They're very liberal lefties. So it tells that story, which is, I think, in our days, an important story because there's been so many stories and cliches about that era. And this is about real people and real events and their perspective of what's happening, which is the opposite of the right wing perspective that we are more and more getting nowadays.
Well, when I'm reading this first page and I meet these two characters, the narrator, Jackie Klein, and he talks about his friend Lee. And since I know this is part fact, I was wondering, were either of those characters based on your life? Because you grew up in Brooklyn yourself, did you not?
Yeah, the first chapter of the book is really based on my experience growing up in Brooklyn. I drew a lot of the information from the neighborhood I grew up in. Jackie, I think, is really kind of the opposite of Lee. Lee is this tough street kid, outgoing, very emotional, dramatic, driven. And Jackie is this kind of laid back, even shy alter ego of Lee. And Lee inspired him to play rock music. And Jackie inspired Lee by believing in him and admiring him and supporting him as a child growing up in the neighborhood.
So was Jackie like you as a child?
Well, I think Lee and Jackie are parts of me.
Uh-huh. Well, you, when I'm reading that first chapter of it, the neighborhood, so the title of your first chapter, I did have that feeling. It seemed very real, and it seemed like it was coming from truth as opposed to something from someone's imagination. So I figured that much you drew on personal experience. But there's a lot in your book that I thought, gosh, he couldn't have had all these experiences. So I think you must have done some research. For example, later on, your information about intelligence agencies. Now, you were in adoption services, and I couldn't see anything in your book directly where you drew on your experience with adoption services.
No, that's more in my second book. But my second book is a murder story about an adopted kid who is accused of a murder. But Lee takes his childhood trauma experiences. There's this stuff in the first chapter, not only about the neighborhood and there's the stuff in there about his family. His mother has mental health problems. His father is a frustrated jazz musician, and he wants Lee to follow in his footsteps. But Lee gets turned on to rock music. And so the political stuff expands as Lee travels around the country, and sees things. His political consciousness expands. I think it started, you know, in the neighborhood. There was a part of the neighborhood was a little small little black ghetto, and Lee was best friends. Lee and Jackie were best friends with some of these black kids, and one of them was an older kid who kind of there's an incident in the book in the chapter where Lee meets these kids. There's one kid that Lee's knows from school. He's in all his classes, and they sing together at school. And then he meets their older cousins. He's trapped down in his ditch in this construction site, and the local bully traps him down there. And the two older cousins, Josh and Natron, get him out of the ditch, and they become blood brothers. And Natron, it was like a protector of Lee and Jackie from and some of the younger black kids from the local bullies. And Natron joins the army right out of high school, and he gets killed in Vietnam. And so that was the beginning of his political consciousness. And then Catalina, his girlfriend.
Well, yeah, before you go and before we talk about Catalina, when I read that story, I was hoping that was not fact-based. Was it that this kid got thrown in a ditch like that?
Oh yeah, that really happened.
Oh geez. Well, now you did mention this graduate student that they meet, but now Lee wrote original songs, and
yeah,
I was interested in what he said when people ask him about his original songs, because I've heard this from other songwriters and other artists. When asked about his original songs, Lee went on to say that he did not like to take too much credit for writing some of the songs. He told Catalina that he was merely a vehicle for the music that often came to him almost out of the air, naturally, sometimes in a dream or half-awake state. "I've been lucky and aware enough to pluck the music out of the air as it visited me," he said, with a satisfied grin on his face, as if fascinated by the poetic image he envisioned, but which he truly believed. Now, that I've heard other artists say that, other songwriters say that, so I believe that was fact-based.
Yeah, in writing this book, I wasn't a songwriter. There's a lot of music that's suggested, and there's lyrics. But I would have ideas, and often I'd dream them, and I'd wake up and I'd write down the idea and the lyrics. And it's part of the creative process that I was trying to get across in the book. I wanted readers to get a sense of what motivates these musicians. What are they feeling when they're on stage playing music? What drives them, and what's their creative process like? And so I put that in, and actually a good friend of mine who allowed me to use some of his songs for a screenplay that I'm working on this book, he told me that he loved the book, and he said, "You think just like a musician." And I thought that was a great compliment. That's what I was trying to get across, that, you know, because, you know, when you write a book, that creative process is, I start out with an idea, and it just kind of evolves like real life. And the characters take on their personalities, develop throughout the book, and they kind of lead you along the way.
We'll continue our conversation after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Larry Levin, author of The Leon Lewis Band. And he's introducing us to some of the characters in the book, and you mentioned a young woman named Catalina. And who is Catalina?
Catalina Blake is a young, very passionate Latina journalist that Lee meets. She's falls in love with the band, and she falls in love with Lee. And there's a scene in the book where they're on their first U.S. tour in Texas, in Austin. And just before the tour, it's the last leg of their tour, Lee gets a call from his hysterical mother who wanted to get in touch with him, and he didn't want her to because he knew that she would cause problems. And so he gets a call from her. It tells him that his father had died, which was a lie.
Larry, when I read that too, I was hoping that that wasn't true. That's a terrible thing for a mother to do to her son.
Yeah. So she saw that was the only way she can get through to him. Well, that really got to Lee emotionally. And so when he got on stage for that last show, he was on fire. And Catalina, who had followed some of their other concerts throughout the state of Texas, she wiggled her way up front stage, and she made eye contact with Lee. And then after the show, she was able to get their manager to arrange an interview. And she interviewed the band, and that's where that scene was where he talked about his creative process. And so they hit it off. They become lovers. And Catalina has this incredible history that I use to tie in the political and the personal in this story. And she has a father who was estranged from the family, who her grandparents, who in Guatemala City had this little store, grocery, and they found her father beat up on the street in front of their store, and they took him in. And
well, now Catalina is interviewing Lee, and she writes this article because she is, like I say, she's a graduate student there. And she writes an article. In the article, she says, "The Leon Lewis Band, a psychic sound machine, stirring it up one song at a time. Watching them perform is like being taken for a magical carpet ride. They start off in the present and then take you back to the past. But before you know it, they have you zoomed off into the future on a psychedelic ride on a smooth roller coaster." Who are these guys? I'll tell you who they are. And that was the start of this article that Catalina wrote about the band.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so that really, they were getting mixed reviews until that, partly because of their politics. And so that really caught their attention. Lee gets to know Catalina, and her estranged father. At some point in the book, he calls her to come see him. She hasn't seen him in years. And he tells this incredible story about why he was estranged from the family and what really happened when he was found beat up on the street. And it turns out that he winds up marrying Catalina's mother, and they come back to the States, but he was able to get his family back to the States as a result of agreeing to work for the government. And so he was an asset, and that's why he was estranged from the family. But he was in Guatemala because he has a brother who was a radical priest. And as the years went by, he was being pursued by the authorities, and he was hiding out in the Guatemalan jungle. And so Catalina's father, Antonio Blake, is working both sides, and he cooks up a scheme to get Catalina to help his brother escape out of the jungle in Guatemala.
My guest is Larry Levin, and he has written a novel, The Leon Lewis Band. And Larry, I noticed, and I don't know if this was intentional, but both the title and the author are alliterative. Larry Levin writes about the Leon Lewis Band.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that was intentional.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that just kind of came to me, you know. I didn't want it to be the Larry Levin band.
Well, and Lee didn't either. He didn't want it to be named after him either. He didn't want it to be the Leon Lewis band, but that's the way it turned out.
That's true.
Now, this band is quite successful. They're called a country band from New York City. That seems contradictory label there.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
They have such success that they go on a tour of Europe. And I was especially interested in some of these places because I've been to a lot of them. Florence, Italy, I have not happened to have been to Florence, Italy. And they really had a wonderful time there. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you had been actually to Florence.
I've never been to Florence. I have relatives that live in Naples, but never been to Florence. I just did some research on it. And I thought it would be a great place because of the history of the Renaissance and the art. Because Catalina's father was this artist, and his first wife was in Italy and in Florence, and so I figured that would be a good tie-in.
Mm-hmm. Now you have them. I kind of skipped ahead on their tour. You have them going to the Santa Maria Novella train station there in mm-hmm. Florence, but before they get to even Rome, they go to London.
Right.
You'd tell us what year this was. You say they left New York City for London in May of 1977. They went to Paris, to Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Spain, Rome, and to Florence, and then from Rome back to New York City. And I was interested in their journey because I've been to some of those places too, and it was a nostalgic trip for me to go back to that. But you mentioned that Catalina had a direct connection to Florence, so they especially liked Florence.
Yeah, that's where Catalina's father's first wife lived, and she had a brother, half-brother, that she never met. She had had some contact with them over the years, but she was very excited about meeting them in person. And then when she got there, father's first wife, her and her husband, very gracious to them. And she had this room set up, and she had some of the paintings that her father had made that were quite impressive.
And other people were more impressed with his work than he was, it seemed.
Yeah, he got distracted from his art because of drinking. And then when he went to Guatemala, he got involved in the Communist Party when he was in Italy. He stayed after the war and married Bianca, and he got involved in the Communist Party, and he started drinking, and he really wasn't up to the responsibilities of having a family. And then he heard from his brother in Guatemala, and he left and went to Central America.
Well, you mentioned the important people in their lives. And I'm wondering, too, as I was reading this story, some therapists practice bibliotherapy. And that is, they assign their clients a book to read to further their therapy. And I was wondering if there's any takeaway, any moral, any therapeutic lesson that you would have, say, if you had a client, what would you want them to take away from your novel?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think one thing that I tell people is that it's really important to tap in to your creativity. It helps you connect to yourself, and it's important to have something, whether it be music, art, writing, whatever, that you have, and everything else goes away, that you're just in this mindful place in the moment and you're connecting to yourself. And that spark of creativity through that connection can free you. You know, there's been a whole history of artists and writers of all kinds, actors who take their personal experiences and use that to motivate them, just like Lee in this story to tap into their creativity and share their experiences. You know, John Lennon said that he wrote about himself. He wrote about his own life. And if it if other people connected with it, more the better. You know, Paul McCartney wrote that song, Let It Be. He had a dream, said he had a dream about his mother, who was named Mary, who told him, let it be, you know.
Yeah, I'd heard that story.
Yeah, and so and that's another example of, you know, writing a song through your mm-hmm. dream. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's part of it. The other piece is, you know, Lee's mother with her mental health issues and her his father with his struggles with her, who he feels stopped him from pursuing his career, because mm-hmm. whenever he would get a gig, she was afraid to stay alone at night and she would sabotage it. And one of the reasons Lee left home was because he didn't want that to happen to him.
My guest is clinical therapist and is a licensed clinical social worker who is in private practice in Chico. And the novel is entitled The Leon Lewis Band. And there's the point later in the book where a character named Craig arranged some free concerts in Central Park before they left New York. And you write that his introduction fired up the audience and the show began. We started off with a revised version of one of Lee's early songs, Wake Up and Die Right, that we made into a reggae number at Brewster's suggestion. And what was that song like?
That was a song that was inspired from the experience in the neighborhood. It's kind of written about the bully, Wake Up, and, you know, who was killed in a story. He was a big neighborhood bully, and you know, it's the typical bully who would rob kids' lunch money and fighting with everybody. And he had a certain following, but he made a mistake, and he and a couple of his buddies pulled off a little robbery on a local night spot. And it turned out to be a fatal mistake, because it was actually owned by mafiosa people. And shortly after the robbery, he was gunned down on the street, gangland shooting. And so the story, the song comes out of that, and it's sort of a lament about this character, you know, that, you know, wake up and die right. We didn't really want you to die, even though like that, even though you were the local bully and caused us a lot of pain.
Well, I thought it was interesting too, that you tell us what happened to the other two boys, the one that got killed, but then what happened to the other two boys you found out later?
Well, they became police officers in New York City. Yeah, that came out of my neighborhood too. Some of the local bullies did become police officers. So actually those two characters I tie into my second novel called Murder in the Park. And it's about their families and the murder that they got involved in, someone else was convicted of it.
Well, later in the book, almost the very end, there's a character named Josh. And you write, when Josh noticed me standing beside Lee, he turned toward me. He told me that he loved the way I always stood beside Lee, and he wanted me to know that I had something special too. So what was the importance of what Josh had to say?
Well, Josh, you know, early on the first tour of the band across the U.S., they do this big outdoor concert where it's kind of like a Woodstock kind of thing, but not quite that big. But it was an outdoor concert with a lot of different bands. And Lee introduces the band, and he says, my inspiration, my best friend and inspiration, Jackie. And Jackie never really didn't always see that so much. So Josh was one of the cousins that saved Lee from that ditch in the, when they were kids. And Josh got in trouble after he got out of the Army and was wound up in prison. And he gets out and he's meeting with Lee and Jackie, and he points that out to Lee and Jackie, that, you know, how he always, you know, knew that they were special and that they had this special kind of friendship between them, and what he got out of their music.
Yeah, you have Songs of Love. That's what you guys mean to me. Songs of Love, straight from the heart. And Lee and I, looked at each other and smiled. Music is the only thing we know. Music is our lives. We do it because we must. That's the way it is, replied Lee. We all smiled. There was nothing more to be said about it. So this story is one that will hit home to people who lived through that era that you write about. And we haven't gotten too much into the politics of it, but that was a big part then of that story. So you say you now have another book. You're working on your second novel,
Barry? Yeah, I've already finished it.
And in this one, you'll draw on your experiences with adoption services.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about your novel, Larry.
Well, thank you.
I might remind listeners that Larry Levin is a licensed clinical social worker in private practice here in Chico, and he has written a novel that is part fact and part fiction, The Leon Lewis Band. Thank you, Larry.
Well, thank you.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, whose debut novel is Aftercare Instructions.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.